Here's to us, November, and the waning sun, and all the proofs I'd like to prove. We go down tonight.
Hello and welcome to episode 113 of Flags Fly Forever, a Baseball Prospectus fantasy podcast. My name is George Bissell. I'm a writer at Baseball Prospectus. Later on in the show, we'll talk to BP's senior prospect writer, Jeff Paternostro, about the team top 10 prospect lists, and we're going to take an exclusive look at the process behind the BP top 101 list. But first, we're going to be joined by Tim Finnegan. He's a new addition to the BP fantasy team. He's a really fantastic writer. You've read his stuff over at Fake Teams in the past, and his Mets insights over at SB Nation's Amazing Avenue. Really excited to have him on board. Tim, welcome to the show. It's great to have you on.
Thanks, George. It's great to be here.
So I want to start off by discussing your debut at BP. You wrote about StatCast, some of the data and how that can be used in terms of player evaluation. So for those of you who don't sort of have a primer in what StatCast is, it was implemented 2 years ago. Basically, they put TrackMan radar systems in every stadium across baseball, and all of the data you can find on MLB.com's Baseball Savant pages, which used to be the creation of Darren Woolman, who was then hired by MLB to run their data department, basically, there and their databases. So, Tim, I want to start off by asking a little bit about quality contact and what that means, because that's how you started off your piece, and I thought that's a really interesting metric that I haven't heard discussed too much in fantasy circles. So what do you mean when you talk about quality contact? What is that?
Okay, so I'll just give you a brief history on contact quality. Inside Edge is a baseball company. They've been doing contact quality ratings for, I don't know, over a decade, where they would basically take, you know, they would look at the video and determine whether the batted ball was either hard hit, medium hit, or soft hit. And I found that a few years ago. Mark Simon over at ESPN was tweeting out hard hit rate. And I was like, oh, you know, this is pretty cool. What is this? So I got a subscription for Inside Edge, and, you know, I was looking at the hard hit rates, and then I had heard that the Mets had chosen Lucas Duda over Ike Davis because of his exit velocity. You know, I had read that a couple of years ago. So I'm like, oh, okay. So, you know, if front offices in baseball are looking at this stuff, and, you know, when they want to pick their players, then, you know, I think that's a good idea for fantasy owners to try to copy that. You know, these guys are making millions of dollars a year, you know. These are the highly paid pros. If they're doing it, then, you know, we should probably think about doing it too. So, but at the time there was no exit velocity data public. You know, the only thing that we really had was that Inside Edge stuff, you know, the hard hit rate, and the soft hit rate. So I was using that for a while. And then when StatCast came out, I was like, oh, okay, here we go. Now we have exit velocity. But, last year, StatCast only had exit velocity. They didn't have batted ball angles, and that's a little bit of a problem because exit velocity is only a part of the story. Where, you know, if you say you have a batted ball with an exit velocity of 95 miles an hour,
it's pretty good.
Yeah, that's well above average. I think major league average exit velocity is around 88 miles an hour.
Right,
but if the angle is too high or it's too low, then, you know, it could just be a crummy grounder or, you know, a lazy fly ball. So so last year we had a little bit of the exit velocity, but it didn't really tell us a whole lot. But in 2016, I mean, last year in 2015, 2016 is when they started with the angles. So basically, long story short, contact quality is exit velocity plus the batted ball angle. You know, you look at the exit velocity of the batted ball, the launch angle of the batted ball. You look at the previous outcomes of similar batted balls, and that's – there you go.
Yeah, one of the early developments that came out earlier this year in 2016 was sort of the understanding of the – combination of exit velocity and a launch angle to sort of basically what results in a home run, the combination that you need, the zone you need to be in order to hit a home run. So that was something we discovered fairly early on. So what are some of the practical applications of quality contact? Because you mentioned context sort of being the key. I think that's the big thing to look at with this, right?
Right. So yeah, that was a long-winded answer. I should have got to the point quicker. Basically, okay. So how many times do you hear like, okay, this hitter has a 250 batting average on balls in play. He must be unlucky. And I always kind of like roll my eyes when I hear that, because how do we know he's unlucky if we don't have the exact angles and velocities that he's hitting the ball at? I mean, he could be unlucky. He could be hitting, you know, line drives or hard grounders, and they're just finding gloves. And if he keeps hitting them that certain way, his luck's going to turn around. But not necessarily. I mean, I've watched a lot of players hit, you know, weak grounders or lazy fly balls. Like, the you know, some batted balls have expected BABIPs of like 100 or you know, if you hit a ground ball with a launch angle of negative 25 degrees, you have an expected BABIP on that ground ball of around 100. So if you're hitting crappy, you know, if your contact quality stinks, you're going to have a below average BABIP. And it's the same thing with pitchers. I mean, you know, fielding independent pitching, I really like that statistic as a peripheral statistic, but I always thought it was kind of crazy that people are using this as, you know, as a war formula, you know, because some pitchers just get hit harder than other guys. Like, you know, how many times do you see a pitcher, you know, he gives up, for example, a pitcher gives up 100 mile an hour batted ball at a 15 degree launch angle. It splits the gap for a double. If he gives that same batted ball up at a 30 degree launch angle and it's a home run, you know, he gets penalized for that because technically a home run is within his control. But now you're saying that, you know, the hard line drive into the gap, that's not in his control. So I was kind of like, I don't know about this.
It's basically every conversation anyone's ever had about Robbie Ray.
Right. Yeah. So Robbie Ray, that's a great example. He has incredible defense independent pitching metrics where his strikeout rate is really high. He's got a good walk rate. But his BABIP was like 350 last year or something like that, which is very, very high. And then if you look at some of his contact quality rates, you know, he gets hit pretty hard. I mean, it's not, you know, 350 BABIP for a pitcher, that's really high. That's probably, you know, he's probably had some bad luck, but to just chalk it up as all bad luck and say that it would regress the league average, which is around 300.
Yeah.
You know, he's going to have to, you know, stop getting whacked around so hard to get it closer to 300.
Yeah, so that's why DRA actually likes him, deserved run average, which we have at Baseball Prospectus. It loves him because he does a lot of the things that successful pitchers do. Obviously, his control is not the best, but he strikes a lot of guys out. He gets a lot of swinging strikes. But when he makes a mistake, it typically gets crushed. Sometimes over the fence, sometimes, you know, with two guys on, it's a gapper and a couple of runs score. So, yeah, I'm absolutely with you there. But getting back to hitters quickly, so basically what we can do, this isn't something you can do in every single case because every individual player is different. Every batter is a unique organism, so to speak, from a data standpoint. But by comparing the overall quality of contact and the expected BABIP versus some of the actual results, we can tell a lot about performance in terms of whether or not a guy is getting lucky on ground balls or if he's hitting a lot of line drives right at fielders and he's been unfortunate. And that's something I don't think we could do before, other than you'd get the cryptic quote in the paper from the hitting coach or the manager where he'd say, well, he's hitting the ball hard, he's had a lot of loud outs or stuff like that. And a good example of that was Alex Bregman last year. When he came up, he was mired in that huge slump. And, you know, the data kind of bore out that he was making a ton of quality contact. He just was getting extremely unlucky in terms of the results out of that. So is that a fair way to look at it, that, you know, by comparing those numbers, we can draw some conclusions in some cases?
Yeah, definitely. That's the big thing that I really like about contact quality statistics is you can kind of see like, okay, you know, is a guy getting unlucky, or maybe is a guy getting fortunate? You know, maybe he's hitting, you know, maybe some weak fly balls are falling in, or some weak grounders, or you know, it can go either way.
All right, so just a little bit about exit velocity, because this was brought up in the comments in your piece, so I wanted to address it. But what we know about exit velocity is that through research by Russell Carlton, it's about 40 batted balls. We have a pretty reliable, statistically significant, reliable exit velocity number. And our colleague Craig Goldstein pointed out that it's not necessarily predictive of future performance, but it is a reliable number that it gives an accurate representation of that. So any other stuff on exit velocity or quality of contact before we move on to pitching? Because that's a whole different animal.
Yeah, just the same thing. Like, you know, don't automatically assume that a guy with a below average BABIP is hitting into bad luck, because, I mean, he might be hitting into bad luck, but you don't know that. If he's hitting, you know, a lot of lazy fly balls, or if he's, you know, hitting, you know, crappy grounders, he's going to have a below average BABIP, you know? So that's all. Yeah. That's all I can add there.
Awesome. So let's talk a little about spin rate. And for our listeners that aren't up to speed on it, I'll give a brief primer here. And Tim, you can feel free to jump in and correct anything I say if it's wrong, if I'm flat out wrong, because sometimes, you know, I am. But simply, spin rate is a Statcast measurement of how many times the ball rotates en route to home plate, which is measured in RPM, revolutions per minute. Now that we have two full seasons of data, we've kind of found out that not all spin is alike. Spin means different things for different pitches, and I want to start out by focusing just on fastballs to start, because that's where we have the most data from the last 2 years. Major league average four-seamer spin rate was around 2,264 RPM, so 2,264 RPM. Most fastballs range from about 1,800 to 2,400. So is this the right assumption here? Because this is what I found through just researching it on my own here, that less spin equals more drop on your fastball as it comes towards the plate, fewer swings and misses but more ground balls, and more spin is the opposite, basically. Less drop, more swings and misses, and fewer ground balls. Is that the correct way to look at spin rates on a
whole? Yep, that's exactly right. Basically, spin rate on a fastball, okay, so if you have a very high spin rate, what it does is it the backspin, it fights gravity more because there's more spin, so it appears to have more of a rise to it. I mean, baseballs don't actually rise, but they just drop less than the hitter is expecting.
Right.
So a lot of times they'll swing under it, or they'll just hit a lazy fly ball. Like Justin Verlander has a very high spin rate on his fastball, and he gets a lot of fly balls. So a low spin rate basically fights gravity less. So it pulls it, I might be having that mixed up, but basically a low spin rate, its effect on gravity, where it drops more, mm-hmm. and it'll lead to more grounders, less swing strikes. And then, so an average spin rate, I guess, I don't know if I want to say that's flat, but, because your spin axis also has a lot to do with movement on the pitch, but, so basically I would say, you summed it up pretty good.
Yeah, there's the two poles, sort of the 1800 and the 2400, and the closer you are to either one, the bigger impact it has on how your fastball comes at an opposing batter, I guess would be the way to look
right.
at it.
Right. I just want to add, spin rate on a fastball, more is not necessarily better, it's just different. And less isn't necessarily worse, it's just different.
So why are we talking about this? What is the tangible fantasy impact of this? Because if you're listening to this and you're not a big data person, you say, well, I'm not going to break out my Excel spreadsheet and figure all this out. What's a practical application of this? Because that's something you touched on in your column.
Right. So I wrote in my piece. So basically last year, I was down in spring training early in March. I stood right behind home plate and I watched Matt Harvey pitch in Disney against the Braves. And I was like, wow, his slider looked incredible. His fastball was explosive. He was hitting 99 miles an hour in the first inning of his first spring training start. I was like, wow, he's in like midseason form. Like he looked as good as he did at any point last year, maybe even better because of how sharp his slider was. So naturally, I'm watching his first start of the year against the Royals. And I'm like, he was okay. He wasn't bad, but he wasn't great. And then I watched his second start against the Phillies, and he's not missing bats. His pitches are flat. his command really isn't as sharp. And I'm like, what's going on here? Like, I think Harvey only had like 5 strikeouts through the first 2 games. I was like, wow, that he should be having 5 strikeouts in 5 innings. Like, what's going on? So then he had to start against the Indians where he kind of got lit up and his velocity was down. And I'm like, okay, there's something up here. So I started, you know, I had read that spin rate can be an indicator of injury if your spin rate has dropped from where it's normally at. So I noticed that his fastball spin rate had dropped from last year, where last year it was around 2,300 RPMs. Mm-hmm. And then this year it was down to just over 2,200 RPMs. I don't know, it was a drop of like 80 or 90 RPMs.
That's
significant. At the time I didn't really have enough information to write about it because I didn't want to write something that could make, you know, that was speculating that Harvey was injured if maybe he really wasn't. And so I just kind of sat in it. Like, I actually, you know, Jarrett Seidler, one of our BP colleagues, I actually had a private conversation with him about it at the time. I was like, hey, you know, Matt Harvey's fastball spin is down. So we kind of talked about it a little bit, but like I said, I didn't have the confidence to really write about it. But then he was shut down with thoracic outlet syndrome in July. And in his last start before the DL, his average fastball spin rate had really dropped. It was down to like 150 RPMs. Mm-hmm. So basically, that's a long-winded answer of saying you want to monitor a pitcher's spin rate if there's changes. And if there's changes, there could be an indication that the pitcher is either fatigued or maybe he's pitching through an injury. And, you know, if you're a fantasy owner and you see that your pitcher's fastball spin rate is dropping, you'd be like, you know, maybe I should think about trading this guy, you know. I'm not saying you should definitely do that. I'm saying that, you know, we should, you know, pay attention to this and pay attention to some more research that comes out because, you know, this, you know, could possibly be an early indicator that something's wrong. And, you know, it can maybe help you prevent from trading for somebody or, you know, making a bad move in your fantasy league. So
that's a good way of looking at it. And I think some of the things that we always look at when we're evaluating a pitcher, not only do we go over all the surface stats, ERA, WHIP, DRA, K per nine, everything like that, but I think now we've been using pitch usage, pitch velocity. Those have been some of the indicators we've used in the last couple of years as part of our analysis. And I think you can add spin rate to that as something to factor into your player evaluations and your decision-making process. I think it's something that can improve things from a metric standpoint. So I'm absolutely with you there. You kind of pointed out how you can use spin rate to identify pitchers that maybe have some red flags, but going the other way, we've heard about teams for years using spin rate to identify talent. You know, Colin McHugh's a good example of that with the Astros, which is going on like 5 years now. But can fantasy owners sort of use spin rate to identify pitchers maybe trending in the opposite direction? Because you mentioned a prominent example of this, but Mike Petriello wrote about it last offseason. Justin Verlander, you know, his velocity ticked back up, his spin rates went up, he was having success pitching up in the zone with his fastball. Maybe can we reverse engineer what you're talking about with Harvey and use it to identify good pitchers who may have a chance to outperform what we expected coming into the year?
I don't know. Jeff Long had a really good piece at BP about spin rate. And basically what he found is that spin rate only accounts for maybe 30% of pitch movement. It's really not hugely important for pitch movement. It's really the spin axis. You know, how exactly does the ball rotate on its way to the plate that really influences movement? So I would say at this point we should probably just stick to using spin rate as injury diagnosis. But, you know, if a guy has a huge spin rate on his fastball, you can probably say, okay, he's probably going to get a lot of swinging strikes with his fastball. Maybe, you know, if maybe his strikeout rate isn't that great at the moment, maybe you could say, okay, there's some potential here that this guy can maybe miss bats if, you know, maybe he just starts locating his breaking stuff a little bit better. So that could be, you know, something we can use in fantasy, you know, because strikeouts, you know, are real important in fantasy leagues. So
to kind of round things off on a spin rate, is there anything else that you think is important that we should be focusing on? It doesn't have to be StatCast related, but is there anything that you found to be extremely helpful as we sort of get into the stage where you're building your player projections, your values, and you're looking ahead towards draft preparation? Is there anything that you do yourself that you think the general audience listening to this podcast could benefit from by doing?
Well, I know we're going to be doing some ADP analysis.
That's my department.
That's your department.
My end of the story, yes.
So basically, my big thing is I like finding value, like undervalued assets. Like last year, I wrote a piece about how I thought Daniel Murphy was going too late in fantasy drafts. I didn't think he was going to be like the next Mike Trout, but you know, he was like a top 10 fantasy player last year, Murphy. But I thought, you know, he was going, his ADP was around like 160, 170. I was like, I think, you know, I'm buying into his mechanical changes. You know, the way he dominated that pitching in the postseason, like he wasn't hitting home runs off crap. You know, he was hitting home runs off Kershaw and Greinke and Arrieta and all these monster pitchers, you know, John Lester. I'm like, okay, I think this guy's actually, you know, he's going to hit some for some power. He's going to hit 20 home runs, blah, blah, blah. So basically, I like looking at average draft position and I like saying, okay, this guy's going later than I think he should, and I'm going to target those guys, and I want to find guys who, you know, are going to outperform their draft positions for my fantasy teams. And that's how I think you can build a pretty strong fantasy roster.
Yeah, so absolutely, that's a thing for me that, you know, I do my own projections, and I obviously use a number of sources to compare those against and to refine everything. But I think that's something that over the years, you know, Larry Schechter wrote about it in his book. You know, I think this has been, you know, pretty hashed out there, that you want to compare where you are on a certain player to where the general consensus is, or where you think people in your league or you're drafting against are going to be, and figure out where you might be able to extract that value ahead of time. So like you did with Daniel Murphy, where you're saying, well, my projection has him more valuable than where the ADP is going to slot him. That's absolutely a key thing to do. So I'm with you, you know, lockstep on that. And that kind of ties in nicely to where we're going with everything. So the next couple of weeks at Baseball Prospectus, starting on Monday, we're going to have our positional preview series. We have a ton of content coming with that. Each week, we're going to have a state of the position in our positional rankings, starting off with catcher on Monday. We have the early ADP analysis, emphasis on early. Now, there's not a huge sample of drafts that we're going to be drawing from to do these, so bear with us in the early part of the year. Some of the ADPs can be a little wonky early in the year, so we'll identify those and we'll try and talk about those. But those are my pieces, so you should read them. They're a lot of fun. Jeff Quinton is coming back to write the Quinton, which is a process-based, oriented review of each position. Those are really good. We have our dynasty rankings as well, with Ben Carsley putting those together. Those are great. We'll have target and avoid for each piece. We'll have some tail of the tapes. We'll compare, Trey Turner and Mike Trout, or I don't know, whoever. Every week we'll go toe-to-toe on guys. And we also have this podcast and Tino as well. So we have a wide range of ways you can consume fantasy content. We have some new writers, and one of those is Tim Finnegan. So, Tim, really thank you for taking the time. It's great to have you on board. We're really excited to have you with us here at BP.
Yeah, same here. Thanks for having me on.
All right, so we're going to take a quick break right now. We're going to come back and talk with Jeff Paternostro about prospects. We'll be right back here on Flags Fly Forever. Welcome back to Flags Fly Forever, a Baseball Prospectus Fantasy podcast. Joining us now to discuss the BP's Team Top 10 Prospect List series and take us inside the process, the construction of the BP Top 101 Prospects List, is Baseball Prospectus Senior Prospect Writer Jeff Paternostro. Jeff, thanks for taking the time out of your busy schedule to talk with us tonight. It's great to have you on the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I want to get right into the team list because you know, just reading these, I thought one of the most revealing parts of the team top 10 list series, which we're about halfway done at this point, is sort of how the teams, from an organizational philosophy and process standpoint, have really built their systems and used that talent to produce major league talent. So I just was wondering which teams you thought were the most interesting in regards to how they built their farm system and then how they're using it, how they're turning that into value at the major league level. So I just wondered what were some of the more interesting systems from that standpoint.
Well, you look at the sort of the top teams or top organizations, and we have some org rankings coming out in the annual as well. The common denominator there is, and I don't know if that's due to just happenstance that it happened to be a particularly busy trade deadline and offseason this year compared to past years, or if this is a trend to look towards going forward. But the top four or five systems in baseball all heavily supplemented their system by trading major league talents. We're talking about organizations like the Yankees, the Braves, the White Sox, the Brewers, the Phillies even, though their trades are a little bit further back at this point. But the prospects are still there, of course. It seems to be a shift in the pendulum. It seemed like there were stories being written a few years ago that all these teams are overvaluing their prospects. You know, nobody will trade a prospect at the deadline. We get some quiet deadlines because of that. And now this year, for whatever reason, it just sort of exploded. I don't know if that's specifically due to the deadline situation. The teams were in the expanded wild card. As teams are sort of figuring out whether they want to buy or sell as we get close to the deadline. You have more teams in it, of course. And also just different types of players being more valuable than they were in the past. We saw it with the Andrew Miller and the Aroldis Chapman trades at the deadline this year. It would have been anathema to a Sabre-friendly front office to make a deal like that at the deadline even a few years ago. Obviously, the Eric Gagne deal got pilloried as an example of that. Teams seem really more willing to trade potential impact prospects for even a rental reliever like Aroldis Chapman. And the Yankees certainly made hay with both their relievers and now have one of the best systems in baseball because of it.
You mentioned that in the Brewers list, which just came out this week. It was interesting. On the top 101 list, I think right around 30 of those players are concentrated within those four organizations you mentioned, in the Yankees, Braves, White Sox, and Brewers. And I just think, you know, that's pretty fascinating that we have such a concentration of talent in those systems. And you mentioned some of the factors that have gone into that. But do you think part of the reason is that some teams, and just off the top of my head, you know, teams like Arizona, Miami, they just haven't placed a lot of emphasis on drafting and developing talent, signing international free agents? Do you think that's part of the process, that those teams have just been a little bit resistant to doing some of those things? And then Boston trading away just a haul of prospects this offseason didn't help them probably in the long term. But do you think that's maybe part of the equation as well, that's maybe why we're seeing such a concentration in those, you know, handful of systems too?
Sure. Teams have their own philosophies, and I think we've already seen it start to change with the Diamondbacks as well.
Right.
And even the White Sox would have been one of those teams literally up until this offseason. They famously really didn't. I mean, they bought fairly heavily in the Cuban market, like the older Cuban free agent market, but their actual sort of Dominican IFA strategy was far, far behind most other major league teams for years and years. And they've never drafted particularly well in the recent past. And until the series of trades they pulled off this offseason, they really would have been a bottom 10, maybe even a bottom 5, though I think the bottom 5 is so bad, I don't even know if they would have cracked that this year. Mm-hmm. But until they did that, I mean, they basically added 5 or 6 top 100 prospects to their system, and that kind of thing can swing it a lot.
Absolutely. So looking at the top 101 list, which for all of our listeners, I think is one of the most critical documents that gets put out there every offseason. Everybody in the fantasy community, at least, they've kind of been obsessing over prospects for a long time. And I think 2015, when we had such a crop of productive rookies come up and make an impact, that's only heightened the interest in prospect lists. So I want to talk a little bit about this year's top 101 list, which you can get in the 2017 BP annual. You can pre-order it today for everyone listening. I know Jeff will appreciate that plug.
Nice plug. Amazon.com, by the way.
There you go. But last year, Dodgers shortstop Corey Seager was a relatively easy, non-controversial pick as the top prospect in the game, partly because he had spent nearly a month in the major leagues and hit like 400. So I'm wondering, was there a clear-cut choice at the top of this year's list, or was there a bit more debate than usual at the top spot?
There was for me. There was certainly some debate. I think you could have legitimately put any of five guys as the top prospect in baseball. Obviously, J.P. Crawford was number one on our midseason list, and he's still going to be in that mix. Guys like Yoan Moncada, of course. And then you have some guys that were very good prospects at midseason and maybe raised their stock a little bit with their major league performance. And I mean, all three of them are barely prospect eligible, but they still are prospect eligible because they've retained rookie eligibility, though only in the case of Dansby Swanson, only by one at bat, but also Andrew Benintendi and Alex Reyes. And I'm the average fantasy player probably already owns them, or they are owned in their league. But I think, depending on what you want to weight, you could put any of those five guys as number one on your prospect list, and I'd be just like, okay, that's fine. I can't really strenuously argue with that, but you got to pick somebody in the end. And I think there was some healthy discussion about it, but I would say the player that was number one on my list in my first draft was number one on my list in my last draft. So,
absolutely. I won't ask you to reveal who that is. You have to buy the annual to find that out. So I'm not going to spoil that here. But how does the top of the list and sort of that crop of players there compare to some of the previous year's list? Because I know for a while we had just, it feels like over the last 2 years, just such an absurd amount of talent graduate to the major leagues that it feels like we're going to kind of go into a little bit of a down cycle here in terms of the volume of impact talent that's actually going to reach the big leagues. So how does the top of this list sort of compare with the last couple of seasons? Is it a little bit weaker, or is it just as strong as we've seen in some of the past couple of years?
I think the guys at the top are still comparable to, you know, if you look at the top 10, I guess that's kind of an arbitrary endpoint. Mm-hmm. But the top 10 on this list is certainly comparable to recent top 10s. I think it where you really start to see it drop off, and I know that was sort of my process going through the list, is maybe around 25 or so, maybe even a little bit before that. Between like 20 and 50, I'm just like, are these guys really top 50 prospects in baseball? Like, they feel like more like 40 to 60 type guys to me, but there's just so many of them. Well, somebody's got to be number 33. It's just eventually you got to pick the best one of this group, and that's who it is. But it did feel like that area of the list was a little bit softer than it has been in recent years, even further down the list. I mean, your back end top 100 guys, like your 82-101 is really, you're picking 21 dudes out of a group of 75. They're probably reasonable choices in that slot. There's a little bit of like, I think, false precision. We talk about like how much better the 83rd prospect is in baseball than the 97th prospect in baseball. It sort of overstates the actual gap between the two. Like the difference between the 7th and 21st is probably significant, but I think the further you get down the list, the more it sort of gets compacted.
It's helpful to look at it more from a sort of a tiers standpoint and understanding Sure. There's not a huge gap or disparity in future value between those guys. Absolutely. So you mentioned some of the challenges in how you actually end up ranking players. So I'm wondering, what are some of the more difficult variables that you have to consider? Just for me off the top of my head, if you're constructing a list like this, and you're much better at this than I am yourself and Craig and the rest of the prospect team. But some of the variables I think are just challenging are how you assess risk with profiles and sort of valuing ceiling against floor. What are some of the things that you find most difficult to weigh in terms of creating a list like this?
I think you hit on the big ones, and that comes up all the time. It's like you're comparing, let's use outfielders. So you're comparing Andrew Benintendi to Victor Robles, both of whom are excellent top 10 prospects in baseball. I don't think that's spoiling anything. But you've got one who's a fast twitch center fielder in A ball, and the other who hit 300 for 100 plus at bats in the majors and sure looked like those numbers were not a mirage. Mm-hmm. Like, looks like an all-star level left fielder, maybe even as soon as 2017. Does Robles have a little more ceiling? Maybe. No, he's a sure shot center fielder. You'll find scouts that'll put average or better grades on his power too. You'll see plenty of sevens on hit, run, and glove as a center fielder. You know, that's, you start to talk, you start, if it all comes together, you're trying to talk about one of the elite prospects in baseball, even in like recent memory. Mm-hmm. But it's risky. You know, he didn't, it hasn't all shown up on the field yet. His first taste of advanced day, which was, I think it was like a 40 game sample or so, didn't go great, but he's also like 19. So do you really care about that exactly. right now? But he's also 19. So you're not going to see it probably for another 2 to 3 years. And he's a guy that can move quickly because of his advanced sort of defensive skills and an advanced hit tool for his age as well. But just like comparing those two guys, and even comparing pitch, I mean, this is probably a spoiler. I'll give a spoiler. So we ranked Kevin Maitán. Mm-hmm. Who has not played a professional baseball game yet, not even in the Dominican. There's literally no data other than amateur reports and a really big bonus number that was probably agreed to when he was 14. So, but it's so comparing him to someone like, I think someone that's in that same general vicinity, Hunter Renfroe, who is a college drafted corner outfielder that has already conquered AAA. It's tough, you know, to make these decisions. I mean, you got to make a call, essentially. That's what is a funny story. When I got this job, mm-hmm. the way Sam Miller literally pitched it to me, and I will remember this until the day I die because he knows I hate making prospect lists. It's not my favorite part of the job at all. Is that literally, I don't care what else you do. The only thing you have to do is deliver team top 10s, a top 101, org rankings, and a midseason list on deadline. That's all you have to do. I don't care if you write anything else the rest of the year. But that's the job. So you make a call. And you're going to be wrong all the time. Man, I am going to be wrong. I'm going to have so many guys ranked ahead of guys that are going to end up having better major league careers than them. But you just, Jason Parks used to say it's a snapshot in time. This is the data I have right now. I have my own personal predilections. The staff talks me into or out of things of varying degrees of stupidity. And we go from there. And we publish it. And then we do it again next year. And it's, by April 20th, half of it's out of date.
I want to get your thoughts on who was the most difficult prospect for you to rank, or who sparked the most debate internally on this year's list. Was there one sort of polarizing or divisive prospect that everyone kind of gravitated towards and it was a real challenge to rank them?
I think I'll tell you the guy who gave me the most trouble first, and then we'll get into the group kerfuffle. I think the toughest guy for me to rank, and this has been true for years, is Raimel Tapia, Colorado Rockies outfielder. And I've seen him quite a few times. I saw him in Asheville when he was in A-ball, and I saw him a bunch this year with Hartford. And I get it. I said that when I saw him in Asheville. Like, I get it. It's really cool. Like, I just don't know what this looks like at higher levels. And I saw it again this year at higher levels, and it's like, okay, it's still working and I get it, but just like, what does it look like in the majors? And I still don't know that. And Coors Field will hide a multitude of sins, but it's just, and like, he's a really good prospect, but I think he's a 70 hitter in the majors. And the problem is there's just not much else. And he's probably a corner outfielder. He's the worst base runner I've ever seen in my life. Even though he's reasonably fast, he's like a solid average runner, right. Maybe even plus. He'll give you occasionally in home to first. He'll give you a 60 time, but it's just I don't. And that swing's so unorthodox, and the 2-strike crouch is like a neat little trick, but I'm not sure it actually works. I'm certainly not sure it works against major league pitchers. But he's also hit a ton in the upper minors now, so you can't really just say he's beating up on bad arms. But it's just like, when I'm doing the list, I'm like, I don't know where to put this guy.
Yep. Before you go to the group discussion, I want to ask you real quickly about, is there sort of a little bit of sort of the availability heuristic playing in there in terms of, we don't have any other examples to compare someone like Tapia to? He's sure. So unique that we just have no idea what it's going to look like, because no one's done that before with that type of profile, really.
The phrase I usually use is unusual profiles imply unusual risks. Like, we just don't know what all the risks are and where it might get tripped up. I mean, you think you do. It's like, because it's like, oh, well, he just won't hit enough. He'll hit 270 and the rest of the profile won't work. And yes, that's certainly possible, but you can say that about any hit tool driven player. You say it about Kevin Newman. You say it about Andrew Benintendi, for that matter. But he does offer a little bit more in secondary skills than those two do, of course.
True.
But I think that's not – there's just something about the profile that's always kind of been a little bit confounding to me. And I'm also going against sort of at this point like 4 years of just gushing praise that's written about Raimel Tapia by other people at Baseball Prospectus. And look, I'm my own man, of course. These are my lists. I don't feel like I'm beholden to old reports or old lists, but I think those people's opinions do matter. And should be taken into account.
So who was it among the group who sparked the most discussion on this year's list?
So I'm going to say Gleyber Torres.
Ah, yep. I agree.
And it's – so I don't – when I'm in this process, I don't read other people's lists. I try to avoid any other source of information on this kind of thing. It's like it's impossible because I'm on Twitter and – you're going to see stuff. But as a general rule, I try not to read the content at least whenever possible. But I've seen recently, it's like some really, really high rankings thrown on Gleyber Torres. And I get it, I guess. And he had a great Arizona Fall League. Everybody sees the Arizona Fall League. So that's always going to, there's always one or two guys that jump off the AFL. I don't find the AFL particularly valuable as a scouting thing. I call it like evaluator camp. Everybody sort of gets together. It's like it's more like a social event than it is I think particularly useful. I mean, obviously someone like Kaprelian, if you want to see somebody that's healthy, I think that's important that you get value from that. But
right,
you know, Gleyber Torres beating up on like gassed AA starters pitching out of the bullpen doesn't do a ton for me. And I'm not saying Gleyber Torres is an elite prospect. He's in a great prospect, and we ranked him number one on the Yankees list. We put a future 7 OFP on him. But I just think it's sort of like he's not a slam dunk shortstop.
Right.
You know, even outside of the Yankees organization, organizational needs. The power projection varies depending on who you talk to. And if he's a second or third baseman, there's a big difference between 12 to 15 home runs or 18 to 22 home runs. Everyone thinks he'll hit. He'll probably be a good defender wherever he moves to at second or third, but it's just, you know, finding that spot for him, I think, where you have conflicting reports internally, especially. Those are always the guys where you have somebody loves a guy, somebody doesn't love a guy, basically.
So who's a prospect that you sort of have a more favorable opinion on than the rest of the consensus? I know you mentioned kind of being on the other side of the equation with someone like Tapia, but who to you is maybe getting a bit underrated, or you feel like you have more confidence in than maybe the consensus is on that player?
I mean, people have already made this remark to me internally, but I'm basically stating on my first national 101 list, to a certain extent, I'm stating my professional reputation on how well Robert Gsellman pitches for the Mets this year.
I like it.
And it's not because I am going to be wildly higher, I have a feeling, on Gsellman than most of the sources, but we're probably higher on Josh Hader, and I push that a lot too. There's probably a couple other guys that we're going to be much higher on for various reasons. I mean, the problem I'm going to come into is a matter of perception. You know, I was raised a Mets fan. I do a Mets podcast for the BP Mets site. I still probably identify myself as a Mets fan, and I just ranked a Mets pitching prospect. Probably, I don't know. If I say how many places higher I think it is, I'm probably going to give away the number. But probably significantly higher than any other national source. And I have very good reason for doing that. But there's always going to be sort of a perception issue. Though any like Mets fan on Twitter that followed my work when I was writing exclusively about Mets prospects will tell you I actually hate all Mets prospects. So I don't know where that's actually coming from.
That's interesting.
Huh. But, I mean, and it's not just because he did it in the majors, though it sure looked right in the majors. You know, I've seen Robert Gsellman a lot over the last few years. I saw him in April, you know, after he started throwing the Worthen slider. And it was like, okay, you know, I wrote him up for the site as a OFP 60, likely 50, which is about a half grade bump from where I had him coming into the season. And I even said in the report, like, if the slider comes together quickly, there might even be more here. Well, it came together really quickly, and he added 3 miles an hour on his fastball in the middle of the year. And the Mets, look, the Mets do this. This is what they do. And you don't take team or organizational context into account when making these evaluations. You just evaluate what you see and what you can project. However, once it happens, and once it happens in the majors, you can put that in the evaluation. This is what I wrote about specifically in the Mets essay. I can't just give everyone, I can't give Justin Dunn a future seven slider because the Mets have developed a bunch of seven sliders.
Sure.
And that sure very well might happen. You know, it could happen with a number of Mets pitching prospects. Thomas Zupacki is another one. He actually has a good arm slot for it too. We're a few years away from even having that conversation, but Gazelman showed it off in the majors, and he was showing it in Vegas too. That's the thing. I think there's sort of the idea that I'll be overreacting to 40 major league innings. No, the velocity bump happened in Vegas. The plus slider started showing up in Vegas, and that was back in like June, July before we even got called up. And if you go back and watch the starts, I mean, it looks really good. It's not a slam dunk that he's going to be as good as I'm projecting him in 2017, but all the tools are there, and he's shown them. It's not just, well, he's a Mets pitching prospect, so he's going to add 3 miles an hour and a 60 or 70 grade slider once he gets to the majors. I mean, that happened. That's what we saw. So that goes into the report.
I wonder how you balance the fact that you have so much exposure to someone like Gazelman, and you don't want to let that cloud your judgment or at least impact your judgment, just kind of speaking broadly here. But so how do you manage to balance that where you have so much exposure to him that you don't want to let it impact you, but you get the sense that you're right there, essentially, that what you're seeing is real and that it's actually something impactful that's meaningful. So how do you balance that? Because I'm interested in that aspect of it a little bit.
Well, I think in this case, it's always helpful if you can see any prospect year over year. Mm-hmm. You know, I have looks on Gazelman going back to 2000, whatever was his year in Savannah, 2013, I think. So you get to see how things have developed or haven't developed, and that makes a huge difference. If you know that he touched 95 for you in the New York Penn League, you might be willing to project more velocity there when he's sitting 88 to 92 a few years later. I think more looks always help. So much of our eyewitness reports and notes from the field and stuff like that are done off, you know, three game looks or one game look for a pitcher. And that's not ideal. And it's not like this is an article idea I've had for a while, and I'm actually going to do it this year. I'm actually going to sit on a team for 6 days straight and write it up as if I were doing a full coverage look on them. We don't often get to do that. Now, with pitchers, you're still only getting one look, so it's not as significant information gap as it might be with a position player. You only even see two out of those three games because he had a scheduled day off on Sunday or whatever. But I think more looks are always better for all these players. Now, the thing that struck me and why I'm feeling a little bit better about the Gazelman thing, I mean, it might still burn me in the end because anybody can. I mean, there could be any number of guys I've end up, it looks like I rank too highly because they're busted.
It's going to happen with someone.
It's going to happen. Yeah. It could just as easily be Josh Hader. It could just as easily be, I could be way too low on, I don't know, the aforementioned Hunter Renfroe. Maybe he's an all-star corner outfielder. I don't think so. I would have ranked him like that. So, but yeah, it's hard. It's hard. It's not easy to do, and it's long and it's time consuming. I take it very seriously. The one thing I sort of like hang my hat on here is that for all the feedback I got, and we do like try to get feedback from external like team sources and, you know, people in the industry, even if it just amounts to what in here is going to make me look stupid in 6 months. I got almost no feedback that Gazelman was too high on the list.
Yeah. So for the purposes of this podcast, I bring all this up because in dynasty leagues and long-term keeper formats, you have to make decisions like this, and you have to be able to evaluate things over time as player situations change, as they reach the majors and everything like that. So I think it's interesting to go in sort of inside the mind with one of our best and brightest at BP. So I want to end on a fun note here, because I know this is your favorite question in the game. So I'm going to indulge all of our listeners who are screaming into whatever device they use to listen to this podcast, hey, ask Jeff about a super deep prospect nobody's heard of that I can get in my league to help me win.
All right.
I have to ask you.
So
I'm obligated.
I mean, for context, the last fantasy baseball league I played in was an AO-only league I won after I got a waiver pickup on Placido Polanco at midseason.
Oh, my God.
So you're going to have to tell me how deep you want me to go here.
All right. Well, all right. Let's see. Someone outside the sort of consensus top 200 would be, or 150-ish, 150 to 200 range. I don't know, because I think everybody knows all the sort of consensus top 100. If you're listening to this podcast on BP, you know all about the top 100 guys, but maybe someone beyond that who's in the lower minors that it might be good to get in on now.
I'm actually going to go into my notes for this one. All right, let me see.
Awesome. This is what we want.
Outside of the consensus top 50 or 200.
It's always a fun question. I know you've written about this, and you took Juan Soto as one of those guys.
Well, Juan Soto made our top 101 now.
Yeah, he's moved up. So,
and we even ended up, this is another spoiler, we even ended up ranking Anderson Tejeda, who would have been my other one here too.
Oh, man. So we're going outside of that. Man.
Okay. He's probably still available in part because of some sort of, like, I'm not going to say weird medicals, but there were times when nobody knew if he was healthy. Mm-hmm. And I don't think he's actually thrown a professional pitch yet. But Joey Wentz, who is a supplemental round pick by the Braves this year. If you want to get in on the ground floor on somebody, I got reports that suggested Joey Wentz was equal to, or potentially as good as, any of the top 101 Braves names.
That's high praise. I like it.
Yeah.
Good pick. I don't know much about Joey Wentz, so I know it was a good one. And the Braves have a fascinating system. They just have a ton of arms right now. So that's a great one. Jeff, last thing I want to ask you about is Gary Sanchez and Trey Turner, because those are two really huge names that people listening to this podcast, everybody wants to know what we think about those two guys and what they're going to do in 2017. So how fairly confident are you in them replicating sort of the small sample that they showed in 2016, the second
half? I mean, I'm not that confident that Gary Sanchez is going to hit 70 home runs.
Well, no, but some form of that quality of performance, I guess.
I mean, it's always been in there. With Sanchez,
the reason
he made 7 top 101 lists or whatever it ended up being. Like, the tools have always been there, and catcher development paths are weird. Catchers are weird is another one of my favorite sayings. Like, you just don't know. Like, and sort of like Alfaro, I think, is in the same category now, where, like, the tools are all there for him to have a Gary Sanchez-type breakout. Maybe not to that level, but it's like, you just never know with catchers, but he's going to have the opportunity to play every day, or at least every day in a catcher role. You know, the bat's good enough, they'll probably give him DH time when he's out of the lineup too. And it's just, I mean, could he be a 280, 25 home run hitter as a catcher? I think that's pretty possible. And I know, even I know, that's a monster in fantasy.
You're right. Yeah. Yep.
Turner's interesting, because now it seems pretty clear they're going to move him back to the middle infield. Which doesn't really matter for fantasy purposes, of course, but I thought from what I saw last year, the tools would actually might play better in center. And you see this with a lot of, like, fast shortstops that may not end up with the sort of the hands and the actions for the position. And I think Turner will be okay at shortstop, but I thought he was legitimately a potential plus defensive outfielder, even in center, which from a, you know, actual on-field value perspective is very good. I think, so what it comes down to with Turner is, do you think the power spike is real?
Yeah.
I mean, is he like a 40 power guy now instead of a 30 power guy? Yeah, it's certainly possible. I actually ended up seeing him a couple times, not from my usual vantage point, of course, but I saw him in a couple major league games, and the ball does jump off the bat more than you'd think for a guy his size. And that kind of stuff can, as we like to say, power comes late. And I don't think it's going to be huge power, but again, if he's a low double digits home run guy at shortstop with the amount of steals you expect from a guy with his speed, yeah, I think that's a reasonable projection.
Yeah, he's currently going in the first round of redraft leagues in fantasy right now. So I just think you're already paying for the ceiling.
Yeah, I guess that's probably true. I mean, I don't even know if it's possible to retain shortstop and outfield eligibility, which would make it probably a little more attractive then.
Absolutely. Yeah, I agree. All right, so Jeff, what's going on with the BP list? What do you have coming up there? And where can everybody find all the stuff from the BP prospect team? Because you guys are cranking out just quality stuff every single week, and huge fans. So where can everybody find all of that work, and what's coming up next in the team list?
So we finish up the NL Central next week, and then we head out to the NL West. All that stuff is available at baseballprospectus.com. It's essentially every other day. So it's like two lists 1 week, 3 weeks the next. And it just slowly grinds me down into a fine powder over the course of 4 months, basically. The 101 is locked and loaded and in the annual, as George already said, and I will reiterate, you can pre-order that on amazon.com and you get all the other good content you would expect out of our annual book. Also in there are org rankings. I think we've also included the number one prospect for each system and the individual team chapters this year as well. We'll have org rankings probably shortly after the lists wrap in early February. And I hope this year by early March to have the futures guide ready to go as well. That'll have all 30 of our team lists plus significantly rewritten Nats and Red Sox lists. With new players, and you know, for one or two guys, I probably wouldn't go through it. But since they both, I think, dumped about half their top 10, there will be brand new top 10s essentially for both the Red Sox and the Nats. Probably some other fun supplemental content as well, depending on how much I just want to crawl into a hole and drink for weeks after.
So in case you couldn't tell, Jeff is a very busy man, but if you're so inclined, you can follow him on Twitter at Jeff Paternostro. Jeff is our senior prospect writer at Baseball Prospectus. Seriously, thank you for taking the time. Really appreciate you coming on here. It was a blast having you.
Yep. Thanks for having me. Come on anytime.
And we're back. Thank you for listening to episode 113 of Flags Fly Forever. This has been a Baseball Prospectus Fantasy Podcast. You can subscribe today with a one-year premium membership to read all of us on baseballprospectus.com. If you sign up for a super premium membership, you get exclusive access to the Bat Signal. It's our personalized fantasy answering service. You can send us a question literally anytime. You'll get a response within 12 hours, oftentimes much sooner than that. I want to thank my guest once again, Tim Finnegan. You can follow him on Twitter at TimFinn521. And Jeff Paternostro, you can follow him on Twitter at Jeff Paternostro. Pretty easy there. If you want to follow me on Twitter, I don't recommend it, but at George Bissell. Don't forget, subscribe, rate, and review us on iTunes. We haven't had any reviews or ratings in a while, so, no, we have, but I want new ones. I like to read them. Tell me about your feelings and your thoughts. I want to hear from you. That's the best part of this podcast. So until our next show, we'll be back with Mike Gianella and Brett Sayer. It's going to be awesome. We're going to talk catchers. We're going to blow things out next week. It's going to be a really great show. Brett's coming back. That's really awesome. So thanks, everybody, for listening. Until our next show, so long, everybody.